ಸಾಗರ.
Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today, 2nd of April. Today, we will continue listen to Tenzin's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, welcome to the program, and I hope you'll be able to take away some value from our half hour together. Talking about value, we've been discussing the determination, or lack of, to attain enlightenment to be of the greatest benefit to all living creatures, the mind that we call bodhicitta. This mind has two aspects, the desire to be beneficial to all others, and the determination to attain enlightenment as the best way to achieve that benefit. Only if we have the enlightened mind, with its clairvoyance and other psychic powers, can we really know how to benefit any being. When most of us want to help, we often grope around in the dark a bit, not really knowing what we're doing, because we don't truly know what would be best for those we're trying to help. An enlightened being can read others' minds, and so knows exactly what they really need, as opposed to say, what they think they need. This is vividly demonstrated in the story of Buddha and his great disciple Angulimala, a story so popular in Buddhism that I'm sure you know it. Still, for the sake of the example, let's briefly remember it again. Angulimala was a very good student of a particular religious teacher. He was so good that the teacher's other students became jealous of him and told the teacher that Angulimala was interfering with his wife. The teacher, afraid of directly challenging Angulimala because of his great strength, told him that for enlightenment's sake he should kill 1,000 people and wear a garland of fingers, one from each person around his neck. Thus Angulimala became a greatly feared bandit. The Angulimala Sutta describes him as brutal, bloody-handed, devoted to killing and slaying, showing no mercy to living beings. He has turned villages into non-villages, towns into non-towns, settled countryside into unsettled countryside. When the Buddha heard about him, he decided to go and visit Angulimala. Many people were horrified and told the Buddha he would be killed, but the Buddha just quietly went anyway. When Angulimala saw the Buddha coming, he decided this tall, regal man would make a nice addition to his collection. So, grabbing his sword, he ran after the Buddha. However, no matter how fast Angulimala went, he could get no closer to the Buddha calmly walking along the road. Eventually, he stopped and called out to the Buddha, "Stop, contemplative, stop!" The Buddha turned around and said to him, "I have stopped, Angulimala, you stop." Of course, the bandit was a bit taken aback and asked the Buddha what he meant. "While walking contemplative, you say, I have stopped. But when I have stopped, you say, I haven't. I ask you the meaning of this. How have you stopped? How haven't I?" he asked. Then the Buddha answered him with, "I have stopped, Angulimala, once and for all, having cast off violence towards all living beings. You, though, are unrestrained towards beings. That is how I've stopped, and you haven't." Angulimala was so impressed with the answer that he asked the Buddha to ordain and teach him. He followed the Buddha's instructions so carefully that even in that life in which he had killed so many people, he became an arhat. Now the point of my telling the story here is that only the Buddha knew that if he went and confronted Angulimala, he would be able to change the direction of his life. Everybody else was terrified. Even the Buddha's best disciples didn't have the power to pick up that Angulimala could be so tamed. And so, if we want to help others in the best way possible, we have to develop this mind of bodhicitta, the intention to attain enlightenment, so we can know exactly what the others really require. Now, before we go any further, let's take a moment to set a good motivation for participating in the program today. As usual, try to make your motivation bodhicitta, to attain enlightenment to benefit all beings. Thank you. In our discussion about bodhicitta so far, we've come up to chapter 4 of the great Indian master Shantideva's text, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, a kind of manual on how to develop bodhicitta and act on it. The chapter opens with explaining how, once we've taken the bodhisattva vow, which is basically to act always with a bodhicitta intention, we should never give it up, for then we would fail in our promise to help all beings everywhere. The result of forsaking the vow, Shantideva says, is not being able to attain enlightenment for a very long time. In verse 11 he says, "Thus those who have the force of an awakening mind, as well as the force of falling from it, stay revolving within cyclic existence and for a long time are hindered in reaching the bodhisattva levels. Therefore, just as I have promised, shall I respectfully accord my actions. If from now on I make no effort, I shall descend from lower to lower states." In his commentary of these verses, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says that in this lifetime we have found this precious human rebirth in which we have the conditions to practice the Dharma. We have also come in contact with the teachings and those who can explain them properly. And we have many treatises, teachings and commentaries to refer to. If now we don't apply any effort at developing our minds and stabilizing bodhicitta, if we only just give in to self-grasping and self-centeredness, we will only create the causes to go from one miserable type of existence to another. Without applying effort and determination, we cannot expect to make any progress in realizing what the Buddha taught. In addition, Pema Chodron in her commentary points out that depending on how we use our mind, we can either wake up or just follow our habitual tendencies, which may seem more comfortable, which actually only lull us back into the cocoon of forgetfulness about our real heritage, the fully awakened state. Either we become more flexible and adventurous, she says, or more set in our ways. As we all know, the older we get, the more we tend to settle into our habitual patterns and grumble when our routines are disturbed. We conform more and more to that old cliche, "You can't teach an old dog new tricks." But if we want to progress along this spiritual path, we constantly have to look at our mind and see where it can be transformed. And that process pays no dues to age. According to the Buddha's teachings, there's nothing permanent about us. Everything can be changed. And so we can continue the process of transformation until the day we lie on our deathbed and beyond. Then Shantideva continues, "Although for the benefit of every creature, countless Buddhas have passed by, yet I was not an object of their care because of my own mistakes. And if I continue to act like this, again and again shall I undergo suffering in unhappy realms, sickness, bondage, laceration, and the shedding of blood." Many Buddhas have come and gone. Some have taught and some haven't. But all have had one thing in mind, to benefit as many living creatures as possible. It's said that Shakyamuni Buddha is the fourth Buddha to spread the teachings in this world system, but altogether 1,000 will appear. And in other world systems, many, many other Buddhas have appeared. However, seeing as we are still wandering around in cyclic existence with such deluded minds, it's obvious that we got little benefit from those enlightened ones. This is entirely due to our own errors of judgment and practice. If we'd accumulated the karma to meet even one of those Buddhas and taken teachings and practiced well, we would now not be bewailing our unhappy state. But through our heedlessness and lack of effort in a positive direction, our self-centeredness and disregard of others' well-being, and especially our muddled views about the nature of reality, We didn't create the causes to meet those past Buddhas. Or even if we did, we took no notice, and they could not help us. If we go on acting according to our habitual self-centered concerns, says Shantideva, we will only continue endlessly experiencing the dissatisfaction and misery we're looking at right now. Actually, as His Holiness says, we have a precious human rebirth, which has the most excellent conditions to transform ourselves, so we should use it to its fullest extent. If it was always available to us, if we could be sure we would always meet a Buddha and always be able to practice the Dharma, we could possibly take our time with a relaxed attitude towards the teachings. However, this is not the case. Meeting this precious human rebirth is very rare. I'm sure you've heard the famous analogy that is even more rare than a turtle in a great ocean who comes up for air every 100 years, putting its head through a yolk, bobbing up and down on the surface of the ocean. So we should use this opportunity well, now we have it. Pema Chodron says that the Buddha's blessings reach out to all of us, but they will not touch us if we act contrarily and don't make an effort to practice the teachings. She talks about another famous Buddhist analogy, famous anyway in the Tibetan teachings, comparing students to a pot. We can be like a pot filled to the brim, she says. That is when we've formed our own preconceptions, attitudes, opinions, and so on, and cling to them adamantly, not giving any room for change. We already know it all, she writes. We have so many fixed ideas that nothing new can affect us or cause us to question our assumptions. Or we can be like a pot containing poison. In other words, we adopt an attitude that is cynical, critical, and judgmental. This, Pema Chodron says, allows for no openness and no willingness to explore the teachings or anything else that challenges our righteous stance. Or finally, we can be similar to a pot with a hole in it. Whatever goes in just flows out again. Our body is present, but we're lost in thought. We're so busy thinking about our dream vacation or what's for dinner that we are completely deaf to what is being said. With such a distracted mind, nothing we hear of the Dharma will stick. Now, I've heard the analogy of the pot in a slightly different form. The pot is described as empty, upside down, or punctured. But I think you get the general picture. Nothing, as Pema Chodron says, will improve until we become more intelligent about cause and effect. We don't recognize how repetitive our behavior really is, she says. For instance, when we're challenged, our behavior is particularly predictable. Well, what do you do when suddenly a situation blows up in your face? Hit out? Withdraw? Get arrogant? Or feel inadequate? These are some of the reactions we might take refuge in. If we remember with mindfulness the many times it has happened, I think we can come to see that without thinking, we tend to react the same way again and again, even if that reaction does nothing for the situation. These strategies for seeking security and avoiding discomfort, Pema Chodron claims, only increases our uneasiness. But alas, they seem addictive. Even though the results are unsatisfactory, we use them again and again. Attentiveness functions like a guardian who protects us from repeating the same mistakes and strengthening the same patterns. By being attentive, we can catch ourselves getting hooked and avoid being swept away by that emotional tightening she labels by the Tibetan term shenpa. This teaching hit me quite strongly not so long ago when a stranger turned up at our temple. He said he wanted to know more about Buddhism, not, as I understood it, as something to get into, but more as something to find out and explore a little. I started talking about what a Buddhist believe and practice, but he quickly interrupted and launched into his own belief system and life experiences, and I felt a familiar put-out kind of tightening of my mind and gut, as though he'd not been respectful enough. Then I remembered this teaching and recognized that if I let that tightening dictate my reaction, which I had done many times before, it would not help the situation at all, as it had not done before. So I just sat, listened, and smiled, and soon the tightness loosened up, and I was able to act with a genuine kind of friendliness to him, even as I recognized that he didn't really want to know about Buddhism. Perhaps he just wanted someone to talk to. Slowly we learn. If the addressing of a Tathagata, faith, the attainment of a human body, and my being fit to cultivate virtue are scarce, when will they be one again? Although today I am healthy, well-nourished, and unafflicted, life is momentary and deceptive. The body is like an object on loan for but a minute. When last did you think about your death? I bet that if the thought of dying appears in our minds, most of us will quickly shy away and distract to something else. And yet the only thing we can say for sure about the future is that we're going to die. We can do nothing about it, and that might be why death appears so scary to us. We can't make plans against it, for there's no avoiding death no matter what we do. Not only that, but we have no idea when death will arrive and lay its implacable hand on our heart. It could be in a few years, a month or two, next week, or even today. When we don't remember that death is inevitable and unpredictable, we act as though we will never die. Of course, we know we will die, but the effect of thinking it will happen in the future, not now, has the same effect as thinking it will never happen. Even on our deathbed, we will still be saying, not right now, sometime in the future. As His Holiness says, we must remember that our life is exhausting itself moment by moment, and while appearing permanent, stable, and reliable, it is actually the very opposite. Shantideva in these verses mentions some of the factors that need to come together for us to practice the Dharma: the coming of a Buddha, our developing faith in the Buddha and the teachings, finding a human body to practice in, and having good circumstances so that we can accumulate virtue. These all happening at the same time occurs very seldom, and just because we have them now, we should not think they will easily come by again. It may be many, many lifetimes before we get just one or two of them. For instance, through our connection to Buddhism now, in another life, we might be born when a Buddha is teaching, but we may be in a mosquito's body. Then how could we take advantage of the teachings? They would be next to useless to us. Or we might even have a human body, but in such a miserable state of poverty that all we really care about is getting food and a rudimentary shelter. Then also, the Buddha's teachings will mean very little in our life. As Pema Chodron says in her commentary, this precious life is like a dream, but even when pleasant, it is fragile, fleeting, and uncertain. Take it for granted, and we waste it. She notes that in the West, we're generally smug about our good circumstances. But what does the mind do if suddenly the electricity fails for 3 or 4 hours? What do you do if you reach into your pocket or bag and realize that your cell phone is not where it should be? Or if the car breaks down? Pema Chodron says it's important that our conveniences and good circumstances support our bodhisattva way of life rather than hinder it. So when we experience something that makes life easier, we can make a little prayer that all others can share in our good fortune and also find ways to make life more comfortable for themselves. We can see the good things in our life as bonuses rather than take them for granted. Then our mind will always be happy and grateful rather than always be hankering after more and getting upset when technology breaks down and leaves us in the lurch. And with behavior such as this, I shall not win a human body again. And if this human form is not attained, there will be solely evil and no virtue. Well, what would it be like if we take rebirth as an animal? We have a couple of cats at the temple, one of which is a tortoiseshell whose main aim in life is to eat and who is quick to lash out if your friendliness and strokes are becoming a nuisance. She always reacts with hissing and loathing when the other cat, a grey Burmese, is around. This tortoiseshell is a prime example of how attachment and aversion rules an animal life. And when your life is like that, His Holiness says, you might find slight instances of virtuous conduct, but nothing very strong. So it's very difficult for an animal to rise above its state and take rebirth in, say, a human realm. Of course, some quite significant instances of altruistic compassion can be found in the animal kingdom. In a previous program, I mentioned a hippo taking on a crocodile that was trying to drag an antelope into the water for dinner. The hippo rescued the antelope, although it was too badly hurt and died soon afterwards. But the hippo tended to it and tried to keep it alive to no avail. I think such acts must accumulate quite a lot of positive karma, though I guess depriving the crocodile of its food is not so good. But anyway, I should think such instances are not common, and so positive karma is difficult to create among animals. In fact, it's very easy for them to create negative karma. Just think how many worms and other small creatures a thrush kills and eats in its life. Just about everything it does is connected to negative karma. So how can it move into a higher realm? Now, if we're not attentive to the way we act now and continue to react habitually without any intelligence, we are just setting up the causes to be born in an animal realm or worse. And once there, we cannot say when we will again have the chance to be born in a human realm, never mind with all the conditions to meet and practice the Dharma. If when I have the chance to live a wholesome life, my actions are not wholesome, then what shall I be able to do when confused by the misery of the lower realms, says Shantideva. And so he says that if we don't make a conscious and concerted effort to create a virtuous life now, while we have a good human body, we will not be able to do so when life is over and we are born as an animal or worse. We will have a lot of bodily discomfort, while mentally we will be subject to great fear and anxiety, so it will be very difficult to create virtue. This is brought home to me every time I try to put some food out for the sparrows. They're so jittery that they will hang around in trees or even a nearby electric line until they're sure I've gone before coming down to eat. And then, even at the slightest disturbance, they will hike it back to the trees or the line as fast as they can in panic. Also, in cold, wet nights, I wonder about the sparrows and other birds and animals. All they can do is wait it out patiently, enduring the torment of the weather, while we can at least huddle up at our electric blanket. But if we only think of our present comfort and don't do anything to build up positive potential, we could soon find ourselves a two- or four-legged creature out in a muddy paddock, shivering in the biting cold dark. And if I commit no wholesome deeds there, but readily amass much evil, then for 100 million eons I shall not even hear the words a happy life. Here Shantideva says, if we are born in a lower realm, like the thrush, we will only create a lot of negative karma and so for a long time not be born again into a relatively happy life like our present one. In a commentary to this verse, Pema Chodron says that when we are comfortable, it's relatively easy to open our hearts to other people's suffering. But it's much more difficult if we're in dire straits or intense misery. Then we're so intent on our own painful situation, we find very little room to think of others. If we are starving and someone gives us a bowl of rice, do we share it with someone else in the same boat, she asks. Because of our fear of starvation and death, we might find this extremely difficult. For one moment of not starving, we might easily turn our backs on someone else. In that kind of situation, it's much more difficult to access the bodhicitta mind. Right now, because of our good birth, we have a chance to create the causes and conditions for happiness rather than misery, of inner strength and generosity rather than fearfulness and greed. This might not be so easy later on, she says. Then Shantideva goes on, for these very reasons, the Buddha has said that like for a turtle to insert its neck into a yoke adrift upon the vast ocean, it is extremely hard to attain the human state. If even by the evil of one instant an eon may be spent in the deepest hell, then because of the evil I have gathered since beginningless time, what need to mention my not going to a happy realm? And so Shantideva evokes the analogy of the yoke and the turtle to illustrate how difficult it is to take a human body, and says that if one act of intentional harm, even if it is over in an instant, reinforces hellish states of mind, what will be the result of the harm we've caused since beginningless time? Pema Chodron urges us to do a life review, and we will inevitably find regrets for things we have done and said. Yet, she says, that doesn't mean we are doomed. By acknowledging what we have done, we interrupt the ignorance that sustains habitual patterns, and instead of sabotaging future happiness, we cultivate a relaxed and flexible mind. At any time, we can choose the path of suffering or the path of happiness. Perhaps this is a good time to remind ourselves of the practice of the four opponent powers to purify the negative influences on our mind. The first is the power of regret. We remember everything we've done to harm others or ourselves and develop regret for our negative actions. We also think of those actions done in previous lives that we may not now remember, but which have left a pain-bearing imprint on our mind, and develop regret for those as well, even though we don't even know exactly what they are. We can be sure we've created negativities in past lives because we're not yet in a state of liberation. We still have negative karma to deal with. Then the second power is that of reliance. We create negative actions in relation either to the highly realized beings like the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas, or in relation to other ordinary beings. To repair, if you like, those relationships and set our life back on a positive direction, we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and generate bodhicitta, the mind that wants the greatest benefit and no harm at all for all beings. Usually this is done by repeating three times the verse, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. By practicing generosity and the other perfections, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. Then the power of the antidote. This is essentially any action we do in opposition to the negative actions we regret. The Tibetans like to prostrate a lot for purification, but we can also read sutras, save lives, meditate on love and compassion, and so on. One of the most effective antidotes is the meditation on emptiness, which is the final antidote to all negative states. The fourth power is the power of the promise. Here we promise not to do the negative actions again for a length of time that we think we are able to keep the promise. The best is to promise not to do those actions again for life, but we can't always make a promise for that length of time. So then, we promise for as long as it is possible not to repeat the actions. And from then on, we must be mindful to keep the promise, or it won't be very effective. Those are the four opponent powers that can be used to purify the effects of previous negative actions. But if we don't purify our negativities and they ripen for us in a hellish experience, Shantideva lists another disadvantage that will naturally accrue to deepen our suffering. But having experienced merely that rebirth in hell, I shall still not be liberated, for while it is being experienced, other evil will be extensively produced. When in a very difficult and agonizing situation, it's not only difficult to create positive potential, it is easy to create much more negativity. For as Pema Chodron says, intense pain usually hardens us, making us more fearful and self-centered. She points to where the Dhammapada says that intense suffering can awaken great compassion in us. This, she points out, is the Bodhisattva ideal, and the Bodhisattva teachings show us how pain can make us kinder instead of more neurotic. They can link us with others and awaken bodhicitta instead of causing more harm. Otherwise, suffering doesn't free us, it increases our tendency to remain stuck. And on that note, we have to part. Thank you for joining us today. Please dedicate any positive energy from this program to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I hope you'll be with us again next week. Goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful. Beneficial. Empowering.